All right. Let's get fired up here.
Maximum freedom. Read.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom. Read Rothbard.
Hey, and welcome to the Actual Anarchy Podcast. This is that podcast where we talk about movies from a Rothbardian anarcho-capitalist perspective. And tonight we're going to be talking about A Perfect World, a Clint Eastwood joint. And this is a movie that we had actually intended to record a little bit earlier, but that would only be in A Perfect World. Unfortunately, we live in a world where pipes burst and people get food poisoning, and hence we're recording on the day we are going to be releasing this episode. You can find the show notes and more for this at actualanarchy.com/229. And let's say hello to my hetero life mate, Robert Johnson, before we introduce our wonderful guest and get talking about this movie starring Kevin Costner. So that's a bit of a hint on who's going to be joining us. So, Robert, how you doing, sir?
Oh, sir, I've got some sun lately. I don't know about you. I know you're about the same latitude as I am. But over here on the east side of the Cascade Mountains, it is out in full force. And the temperatures have jumped up into the 70s and the 80s. And so I've just been out running around, getting sunburned, riding quads, going to lakes, you know, macking on hot chicks. It's what I do.
So when did Grandma start heading out to the dunes?
You know, have you seen that movie where Napoleon Dynamite, she's like riding the little four-wheeler? You know what I'm talking about? I think that's in Idaho, but I got wind of that. And that is a documentary, as you know. So it's absolutely true. That's where they all hang out.
All right. Very nice. Yeah. We got a little sun ourselves. My kids actually have a little like sun blister on their cheeks and whatnot. Also, I am now out a third Silver Eagle because just today, tooth number three came out of kid number one. So that was pretty exciting.
How many more teeth you got to go?
I don't even know, man. I don't count them. But
they're like 500 teeth in the human body.
She's like a shark, you know? So, speaking of sharks, someone suggested we do Jaws sometime soon, and they want to be a guest. So, we'll be doing that.
Are there some serious libertarian themes in Jaws? What lessons can be learned from a shark attack at a beach? Are there non-aggression principles with shark attacks?
I think so, and I think our guests might have something to say about this when we introduce him on the last nervous person of the show here in just a moment. So why don't we kick that off, and we will be back right after these messages from a couple of midwits. All right, here we go. Hey everyone, it's Daniel Elwood and Robert Paul Johnson. We are the Last Nighters. You can find us at the Liberty Movement's YouTube channel. And you can also find our website at lastnighters.com. We're going to be talking about A Perfect World, which is a Clint Eastwood joint starring Kevin Costner. And this is episode 172 of the show. You can find this at lastnighters.com/172. And our guest is the great Pete Quinones of the Free Man Beyond the Wall podcast. And he would have been on with us a couple of days ago, but pipes have burst and food poisoning has delayed this recording, and unfortunately, we don't live in a perfect world. And in fact, our world is often less perfect than it could be if we didn't have those striving to make it perfect, often ruining things. Welcome back to the show, Pete Quinones. Where can people find what you do?
Free Man Beyond the Wall podcast, any podcatcher, libertarianinstitute.org, and I have a Substack, PeteQuinones.substack.com.
All right. Those are all the great places to find you. And I know that you've also been promoting a link to where people can support the work you do so that you can increase your output and do more film production and more writing and more podcast episodes. You want to just throw that out there for our audience?
freemanbeyondthewall.com/goal. The whole story is there.
All right. Very good. Now, this wouldn't be a Kevin Costner episode without you. So I'm so glad that you overcame the illness that you had contracted. And, you know, there ought to be a law, right? Preventing ill foods from getting out in the world, and some kind of regulation just stopping people from getting sick ever. You know, we need perfect health all the time. You gotta hide in your basement, avoid the sun, and all of those things. And you get a free donut if you, you know, do the dog tricks that they want you to do.
We just need more government. That's the answer.
I think that's the answer.
This podcast from the get go. Absolutely. Yeah. Now, Pete, was this a self-inflicted E. coli wound, or what? Was you out at some place?
I don't know, man. I've been trying to figure it out, where it came from, what did it, and everything. So I've been throwing food out all day and starting all over.
Oh, all right.
Well, I'm glad that you were able to make it on tonight, and we have a pretty good movie, I think, here to talk about. This is one of Clint Eastwood's finest directed films and one of Kevin Costner's finest performances. In fact, I think I sent you a link a few months ago after the JFK appearance. And this was, I think, ranked number one or two as far as Kevin Costner performances. JFK was up there as well. Waterworld was definitely not up there. or was The Postman. But how we usually start this thing off is with the Google description. And normally I would pull it up, but I'm having difficulties technologically speaking. So I'll just give it a read out loud here. And I'll go full screen so people can see me trying to read. Okay, so A Perfect World came out in 1993, PG-13. It's a crime/drama film, 2 hours and 18 minutes, 7.6 on IMDb, 79% Rotten Tomatoes, and 3.7 out of 5 on Letterboxd. 89% of Google users like the movie. The description reads, Butch, played by Kevin Costner, is an escaped state prisoner from a Texas jail. He kidnaps Philip, a young, impressionable boy. As they embark on a trip across the American Southwest together, a surprising bond grows between the convict and his captive, even as law enforcement forces slowly catch up with them. An honorable Texas Ranger, Red Garnett, played by Clint Eastwood, understands Butch has a heart of gold, but must pursue him anyway out of a duty to the law and a desire to protect the child. Came out November 24th, 1993, directed by Clint Eastwood, and of course stars Kevin Costner. Robert, let's go to you for your opening on this one.
It's a little bit strange on that description, just because it says that Clint Eastwood realizes that Kevin Costner's character has a heart of gold. I don't know about that. Maybe at the end he realizes that he's not necessarily a threat to the kid, but from what I saw, it was mostly he was an experienced lawman on a manhunt who was kind of reluctant to, you know, sick all the dogs, so to speak. He was more of took the more like humanitarian approach, treating people a little bit respectfully and whatnot, even despite all appearances, like the FBI guy who's kind of the the careless kind of killer guy who just wants to end it. And then you got the very empathetic female character who's into understanding the motivations of the people and what they're actually dealing with and that sort of thing. And Clint Eastwood's kind of like somewhere in the middle between the female and the FBI guy. Laura Dern plays the female. Like you said, Clint Eastwood did a pretty decent job acting, but I think Costner outshines him here in the main role. I still don't think he's a great actor, but this is one of his best performances for sure. I did have a problem with the kid. I didn't think he did a very good job. He did fine for a kid, but he's still a kid. He's not amazing. And there are some awkward scenes.
Did you not like him in Grey's Anatomy?
I didn't catch him in Grey's Anatomy, Daniel. I don't know what you're talking about.
Apparently, he grew up and continued on acting and was in Grey's Anatomy as of 2009 for one episode. So,
well, good for him. All right. Good job, kid. The movie itself was pretty darn enjoyable. I like that it had some kind of ambiguously gray character in Kevin Costner, who was a fairly pragmatic individual, but he had some kind of moral code. There were lines he wouldn't cross, but he realized that he wasn't a good guy. He was a bad guy, but he wasn't the worst. And it made for an interesting watch because you weren't sure what he was going to do. You didn't know if he was going to kill his friend, well, his escape buddy. And then you didn't know what he was going to do when he, especially towards at the end, when he basically holds hostage that the farmer sharecropper family people.
Yeah. Like,
that was kind of shocking, that whole scenario as that played out. And I'm sure we can talk about that scene in detail.
Yeah, seemed like he didn't know what he was going to do either.
Right. And that made it interesting to watch. It was fairly compelling the entire time. Now, it was the plot itself was fairly, like, not surprising. Like, they got the main character who's like, gonna get to Alaska. I just can't wait to get to Alaska. And anytime in one of these movies, some character says they're gonna get to Alaska, you know they're never getting to Alaska. You know he's gonna die at the end. So that, you know, was fairly predictable. But the choices he makes along the way, revealing his character, was very quite interesting. And I did enjoy that. That struck me as very non-standard Hollywood. It struck me as a fairly interesting character film, which I absolutely enjoyed that aspect for sure. I hated, there were a few things I hated. I don't know if we want to get into them right now, but they were plot contrivances, conveniences, like the whole kidnapping. They were like, oh no, we've got to kidnap somebody in order to escape this neighborhood. And then they just walk out. And then there's just nobody there to stop him. As if they didn't have the kid, it would have been just fine anyway. But I understand the plot had to happen. I wish it had been a little bit more understandable why they had to kidnap the kid. But overall, I enjoyed the father-son kind of dynamic between the two, the convict and the kid. The kid who's this kind of closeted, was it Seventh-day Adventist guy, kid who, and they started off on Halloween. Jehovah's Witness, thank you. And so you have this convict who's like, what? You can't even go to a carnival and you can't ride on the rides and you can't do Halloween. You've never had cotton candy. And he's kind of like reacting to the kid's situation and this kid's situation is acting to him. And it's very interesting character film. Well done, guys. Not a perfect film, but I think we'll have plenty to talk about.
All right. So a perfect world, not a perfect film, but still pretty good. And I'm surprised you haven't already mentioned in your opening here, sort of the plot twist almost, or the reveal that Eastwood had made a bargain to quote unquote protect young Kevin Costner by putting him into jail, into juvie, because his father was abusive. So rather abuse him with the state than with the father. And I thought that that was what ended up creating the criminal that we see in this film. If he had not gone to criminal U, which is what Clint Eastwood was responsible for, I think Kevin Costner, yeah, he might have, you know, had other issues because his dad was a bad dude. But I think that in trying to intervene and trying to help, Red Garnett actually made the situation worse, as most things will do when you meddle with voluntary action with coercion. So anyway, Pete, let's go to you for your opening. And I also know when we were talking in the pre-show about Jaws, that you had something to say. So I want to give you the floor on that one as well.
Oh, go check out on YouTube. There's a video. I think it's by Slavoj Žižek, where Jaws is a complete critique of capitalism. The whole movie is like a critique of capitalism. It's very interesting to watch that video, because I think it's like 20 minutes or a half hour long, and it just goes into detailed explanation about the whole the whole movie Jaws is a critique of capitalism. So people can check that out.
All right. And it's also made mention of in Mallrats, also a critique of capitalism, where, you know, they talk about the moment when Jaws pops out of the water and he proposes to his girlfriend.
So, all right. So Perfect World, it starts off really cringy. I mean, there are some parts that you're just like completely, this is really weird. And my wife said the same thing. She wasn't really watching it, but she was in the background and she was like, what the hell are you watching? And then as it went along, she like got more into the movie. She's like, oh, this is like a really good movie. And basically I guess the aspect that I like the best about it is that obviously there's no father in the picture for this kid, and there really hasn't been. And Kevin Costner just really becomes a father to him. And I think that more than anything is that may be one of the main messages they were trying to send in making this movie. Also, I think they're really showing I think there's a critique of law enforcement in there as well. Obviously, I think most movies have some kind of critique of law enforcement. And it's a timepiece. So do we know what year it takes place in?
63.
The 63? Same year, okay. Right before Kennedy's shot, right?
Okay,
so like a month before. So yeah, this actually ties well into your last episode with us on JFK.
Yeah, so the whole, we were talking about the scene with the sharecroppers and everything, and it doesn't seem like that was had anything racial to do. I think that had more to do with somebody who was just, I mean, I guess we can get more into this, but you know, looking at seeing their father in somebody and just like pretty much seeing red and not knowing what the hell he's going to do.
Yeah.
So I think this is, I personally, to me, and it may be because I had a shitty father. I just see daddy stuff in all this. I see daddy issues in like this whole movie.
Yeah. Yeah. I would definitely agree with that. And I think that's one of the things that made it stand out with, you know, people seeing this as one of Kevin Costner's best performances. They see that interaction with him, like sort of becoming that father he didn't have for a kid who doesn't have a father. Like, I think he sees a lot of himself as a character in the kid in this movie. And so he tries to guide him. It sort of turns him around in some ways. And I also wasn't clear on why Costner was in prison, because didn't he killed his father. And then later on, he says that he had only ever killed another, his father, because he had hurt his mom. And then Pugh, who was the escapee along with him, because he was harming the boy. So I'm just curious, like,
was there a joyride? Did he steal somebody's, like a mayor's or somebody's car and took it on a joyride or something like that?
When he was a kid, though. And okay, and that's what that's got him into the, okay, got him into the, like the juvie system or whatever. And that's what Red Garnett, Eastwood's character, got with the judge and was like, hey, even though we would normally just slap him on the wrists or give him a light sentence, let's come down hard on him because his home life's really bad. So let's let the state abuse him instead.
Yeah, that's a tough one. Do you send the kid, home to their, to the abusive father, or do you send them to the abusive state?
Well, and Clint Eastwood's like justification for that was he said like, well, I've seen some people come out of there okay.
Yeah.
I think that was the quote in the movie. Like, well, I saw some people come out okay, so you know, there's a chance at least, I guess. That's really playing God there with a kid's life. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, abusive. Believe me, being in an abusive home. I don't know, man. Between that and the state, who knows? Especially you have to take it in. I don't know. I've never really done a study into, you know, in the 50s, what being in a state facility would be like or something like that. I mean, you would hope it would be better than today, but who the hell knows? I mean, there was so much less oversight at that time. So,
yeah. And I think that the deputy who was working with Eastwood's character wasn't really even aware of the history between them, because he made some off the cuff remark like, oh, yeah, they sent him to juvie where he like learned to be criminal.
Yeah, and that's something pretty popular, a pretty popular trope about prisons.
Yeah, seems believable to me. I mean, if you're going to put people in close proximity with, you know, people who've committed a lot of crimes, even if you're in for a nonviolent offense or like a drug crime or whatever, because so many other opportunities are then not available to you if you get out, then it's going to seem a lot easier to do something that you've learned in such a system.
Trying to do something here. Apologize.
You take care of what you had to take care of, Pete. We'll hold down the fort.
No, I'm good. Sorry. Fucking hard.
Okay,
here.
Daniel, I'm just gonna like cold cock you with this question. I'm gonna cold cock you. Right.
Let's do this.
Kevin Costner, was he a good dad or a bad dad to this kid? Because he was the kid's only dad. He tied him to the roof of the car and sped up or slowed down. He involved the kid obviously in a lot of dangerous situations.
Mm-hmm.
But he was also quite, you know, a sympathetic, you know, he cared about the kid. Obviously he valued that kid's relationship and he cared about how the kid was going to turn out. Like he was like surrendering / getting himself killed. He was negotiating for this kid to live, you know, something of a life, right?
A normal life. What's that anymore?
It's being locked inside your house and not being able to work as told to and dictated by the government. That's a normal life. What are you talking about?
Exactly. All right. So has your question come to its completion?
I am satisfied with how I have asked this question to this point.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, you know, in a weird way, yeah, I think he was a pretty good dad. He listened to the kid. He tried to teach him life lessons, not all of them good. He also treated him sort of as an equal or as almost an adult, which we try to do with our kids as much as we can. You know, like he was like, hey, Buzz, are you in or are you out? You know, you could stay here and I'll drive off, or you can hop in the car and we'll go. We'll continue on this this journey together. And he did try to give him a lot of those experiences that he didn't have because of his religious upbringing with his family. And so I think there was a lot of nurturing going on and just, you know, general companionship. This is a kid who was, of course, starving for a father. And Kevin Costner's character, of course, knew what that was like. And I think that he took up, I'm going to get a little personal here, but I didn't have a dad growing up. And so when I had kids, because I didn't have a dad, I wanted to make sure that I was a dad and, you know, as good of one as I could be. And I feel like perhaps that was something that I could see Kevin Costner's character doing in this film as well.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, it almost appeared like he was going way overboard trying to be the good dad. And that's I don't know. I don't know. Like, you didn't have a dad. I had a terrible dad. So it's I don't even know when he was doing all that stuff. It's like so foreign to me. I'm just like, I don't know what he's doing. I mean, it seems like that's what he's supposed to be. That's what a dad's supposed to do. You know, because I never had kids. So probably because I was scared I was going to be a shitty dad. Like mine.
Well, yeah. Having a dad, good or bad, can massively affect. I mean, parents are such a huge role. What did you guys think of the religious aspects being kind of undermined by Costner? Because, you know, it's the mother is obviously the primary caregiver, and it's kind of she is the custodian of that kid. And if she wants to raise that kid as a Jehovah's Witness with all the things that implies, what right does Costner have coming along saying, oh, no, kid, you should have cotton candy. You should ride on roller coasters. You should ride in a helicopter, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, I mean, he did kidnap him. So it's not
kind of.
Exactly.
Well, he also offered to not. Here. Yeah.
But I mean, I think that there is definitely some like going against what the mother's wishes would have been. But then there's also like, those are not the norms of society at the time overall. And so he was trying to expose him to, you know, additional culture. But, you know, he also gave him like pretty poor life lessons in you're just borrowing something. You know, you'll give it back when he needed something real bad. It was almost a Kropotkin argument for something. But Pete, I'll send it over to you on your response to Robert's question.
Yeah, that's a tough one, man. The parent is supposed to be in charge of all that. And as a custodian, as somebody who really doesn't like to see people have their choices taken away from them, even as a child, and instinctively, I know it's very unlibertarian to me to say it. Instinctively, I'm like, yeah, that was pretty good, and everything of him to do. And then, you know, to go back to what's basically a property rights issue, probably should have respected the beliefs of the mother, but you know, I mean, he probably doesn't know anything about what a Jehovah's Witness is or anything like that. I mean, he's, when it comes right down to it, he's a simple man. He's just very, very simple. He's not a great thinker. He's not, he's a reactor. And, that kind of like that about him personally.
Yeah, no, as a protagonist, he's a very, he's complex, yet he's kind of easy to understand when he does act it. So somewhat. And I obviously he's not a great libertarian thinker. He wasn't thinking about custodianship and the proper role of the parent versus the child and what he was doing, but he thought he was doing what was best. He thought of himself as at least trying to give this kid some guidance that a father would give. And I appreciated that despite how, you know, I mean, it's obviously not an ideal situation to be in, being on the run, having a kidnapped right. person and whatever.
Now, I'm gonna probably get us in trouble here a little bit, but I knew a lot of religious families growing up that were friends of mine, and they would be in front of their parents and in their church group or whatever, they would be very fine and upstanding and following all the edicts and whatnot. But as soon as you got them alone or out of sight of those things, they would be kind of doing whatever, even more intensely than people who are more free to do those things, because it was like the thrill of something that was forbidden. So examples would be like some of the Mormon kids. They were in big, you know, strict families, and then they would go pretty far into extreme kind of things in high school and whatnot, way more than, you know, someone like me, who I didn't really have very many restrictions. I could kind of do whatever I wanted, and usually it just involved hanging out with Robert. But
the greatest thing
speaks for itself. But, you know, I could see a kid raised in a home like this, where when he was a teenager or whatever, he would rebel and maybe get into worse things than just a normal kid, like, say, Butch might have otherwise gone down a path of if he had not been incarcerated for his own good.
Yeah, I could see that for sure.
Yeah.
What did you guys think of at the end? I mean, I just had flashbacks of Daniel Shaver so much.
Oh yeah. You know, that Bradley Whitford character, which I didn't recognize him at all in this, but he was a sharpshooter. He reminded me of, you know, the Waco incident. Like, they were looking not to bring this guy in. They were looking to shoot this guy. That was the plan all along. That was like the mission that they had in mind. And there's a little bit of ambiguity, of course, in the story, at least from the perspective of what the law enforcement people know versus what we as the audience know. Like, we know he doesn't have a gun, and we know that he's not going to hurt the kid, but they don't know that, or at least most of them don't know that. The Laura Dern character knows it, and Eastwood's character suspects it. He suspects that Butch is not going to harm the kid, but they all think that he still has a weapon, and that he's going to use the kid as leverage for something, you know, to try to escape or whatever. But that FBI sharpshooter was just looking for an excuse, and he saw what he thought was a furtive motion, and you know, he did what he did.
Yeah, I mean, well, from the act of someone coming to the defense of another, I could see how Kevin Costner's not acting with, you know, in an open and peaceful manner, right? He's obviously kidnapped the kid by force in the initial aspects of it. They don't know about him saying, hey, you can come or go, whatever, blah, blah, blah. They think he's being held at force the entire time. So from that aspect, I could see them going, listen, this guy's not an honest actor. If I see anything sketchy, I'm taking him out. But at the same time, he could have killed him at any time. He was obviously turning himself in, walking towards the police. Why would he then only at the very end, obviously gut shot, turn, pull out a gun and shoot the kid? That just doesn't strike me as any kind of logical action. I just don't see it in. If you're in the mind of a cop and you're thinking through the whole situation, it still doesn't make any sense to me that the kid, that he's just going to blow away the kid at that point.
I think it probably was just to show how mindless some police are, and maybe making a statement on federal law enforcement in general. And the movie makes a lot of statements. It makes a lot of statements on culture. It makes a lot of statements on the government at that time. I mean, it was released in 93. I mean, there could have been an inspiration of Ruby Ridge, which was in 92. So, you know, who knows? But that is it's just so brutal, because by that point, pretty much anyone who watches the movie is in love with the character. I mean, I know I wasn't. I couldn't be the only person who was absolutely devastated when the kid, you know, gut shots him. Because, you know, I mean, you can live with one for a while, but the situation he's in, you know, that's probably going to take him out and everything. And then, you do have it. There is a chance he's going to walk over there and maybe they'll get him to the doctor in time. And I mean, just couldn't have been a better shot.
Yeah. I do want to call bullshit on the shot, though. There's no way that the kid fires that weapon and it doesn't like fly out of his hand and smack him in the face or something like that.
Well, what was it? A 38 or something like that?
Yeah, 38.
38 special.
38 could be, I don't know. I've done some light load 38s that have no recoil whatsoever.
All right, well, maybe. The kids seem pretty noodle arm, but especially when
he was holding him in the car.
Yeah, he's holding the car. He's like, it's gonna go whap.
Yeah, it's just gonna eat his face, you know. It's just like, pow, oh, there we go.
Yeah,
remember that old? Remember the old viral YouTube clip? I mean, one of the first
with,
YouTube
like the eagle.
Clips. Yeah, the guy, the girl with the eagle. She's like, she weighs all in 90 pounds. It just, bam! That was such a classic, man.
Yeah, that was good. I'll find that. And try to put that on the page here. So, Robert, it seems like you got a couple of notes here that you're going through as far as like questions for us. So, do you have a few more? I've got a few that I can bring us into as well.
Sure. I mean, there's the big sharecropper scene, which I want to get into. But right before we do that, I do have. I mean, there's in the history of movies and characters in movies misunderstanding what anarchy is, which is, I know, everybody in the world. But at one point, Laura Dern's character and Clint Eastwood's character are having a conversation and they're talking about who's in charge of the operation. And she thinks that there should be some kind of clear, I don't know, line of order from the governor on down as to who's in charge. Like the governor's ultimately in charge and then he designates who's in charge after that and who's in charge after that. But Clint was like, no, I'm in charge. This is my rodeo and I'm going to see it. And I'm going to, if I have to deal with the consequences of something happening, then that's on mine. That's on me. And she's like, well, that's just anarchy. That's just horrible. That's the worst thing ever. And I obviously,
it's actually monarchy, but go on.
It is. She seemed to be objecting to like him taking on the responsibility of it. Like I didn't really understand her objection to it. It seemed like it made a whole lot of sense to me. Like he's the guy with the most information on the ground, knows the situation better. He's got all this information in front of him. And instead of getting a phone call from a governor who's in a room, you know, a couple hundred miles away, giving him the order to shoot or not, who wants to live in that world? That doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, with Clint being the only one who, if he's in charge, if it goes south, you have one person to blame. If you have this line from the governor down, and then you have to talk to all these people, I mean, it's just decentralized, and you know who's going to
follow orders.
Yeah, and who's taking the blame too? I mean, if something goes wrong, who gets the blame? I mean, think about it. Whenever something goes wrong in this government, that you just who do you blame? I mean, if I would rather have one person be in charge of a situation, I'd rather have one person be in charge of most situations, than at least you know where to point the gun. But I think that one person being in charge of a situation like this, especially somebody who's a decorated, experienced law enforcement officer, a Texas Ranger, you know, who's supposed to be the elite of the elite. And you would think that would be a better thing for it.
Yeah, Robert, yeah. I agree with that. And this is, I believe, a point we were making on the Robin Hood episode with when King John went up to the Scottish lords and was like, hey, I'm right here. You know, I'm the guy to be mad at. Take me out if you want.
Yeah. So,
yeah. And I could see Laura Dern's character being into the bureaucratic process. You know, we need a chain of command and we need to do it all by the book and official. She's like this, criminologist, like, university. Yeah,
we don't want some cowboy out here doing whatever he wants. We need to have a chain of command elected by the democratic process.
Yeah, the scientific, you know, progressive kind of like pseudo-intellectual scientistic management of the situation. When Red was more of he's been experienced, he actually knows who this guy is. It's sort of revealed later. He's going by gut and intuition and like past experience.
Years and years of experience, yeah.
Right, and those are things that those are like bits of knowledge that you can't write down and you can't make instruction manuals for. There's a Hayekian term for that, but it's like this, maybe the tacit knowledge. So it's like the things that you know only because you've gone through the experience and you've done the division of labor and you're the one who's like the best at this and you've kind of followed your calling. Sorry, I think I've got some of your
I'm doing it to you, yeah.
mental fog going on. But yeah, so anyway, I wanted to also get into some of the Hayekian stuff because with A Perfect World, and they actually make mention of this, the Laura Dern character, she says something along the lines of, in response to the deputy saying, in a perfect world, we'd have more resources so we could block more roads and throw more men at this thing. And her response to that is, well, in a perfect world, we wouldn't need any of this because this wouldn't have happened. This wouldn't, this criminal situation would have happened. And that's one of the things that we often encounter when we're arguing with people. And that is the Nirvana fallacy that, well, you anarchists, you must have a solution to everything right now, immediately, to any query I have. And it has to be compared not to today, the present status system, it has to be compared to perfection. And that also corollarily ties into how the state apparatus and the media, the cathedral, if you will, has been sort of approaching the pandemic. Well, we can't have any illness at all. We must stamp it out entirely. Any case and any illness and any death is, of course, verboten and no longer allowed. And you will be locked in your homes until there is no more death.
Meanwhile, the state is just held up with good intentions. And as long as they have good intentions, then no matter the horror, they get a pass. It's sweet.
Right. Yeah. So it's that conceit of knowledge. I think Hayek called that the fatal conceit, where people think that they have the expertise and the knowledge to plan for everyone's decisions for them. And I think we see that playing out.
I think it's interesting with the Laura Dern character that she does would probably correlate to a modern day progressive in ways. I also think that it's hard to ignore that Clint Eastwood is, you know, a conservatarian, and that maybe he's really playing that up in there. Maybe he's making sure to show that, that this ideology who, if, I mean, and he's, this is a guy who had his pulse on the culture a long time ago. Even in 1993 would actually be playing up, look at how worthless this person is over here with their idea, how their ideas are just completely worthless. And yeah, I think there might be something there.
You know, I think he did have a little bit of sympathy for her though. Like he did see her as intelligent and as able to contribute something, but he said, I think his deal with her was, all right, I'm making the decisions and you'll be heard. So he's not totally dismissing like what she brings as, you know, the education and the psychology and all of those things. But they both hate the Fed guy, which I kind of enjoyed. They're like, that guy's a piece of shit. He's just going to try to like kill this guy.
Yeah. Yeah. The Fed guy was a one note character and you knew what his deal was from the get go. And of course, he plays the asshole the entire time, which, you know, I didn't hate that aspect of it either.
He tries to make the move on her. So there was also a little bit of that, like, you know, feminist wokeism in this and kind of surprising for when this was made. But I guess it was on the leading edge of that being in movies and television.
Yeah. At one point, doesn't she comment that it's an entire sausage fest and there's no other women contributing to this manhunt or whatever? Okay.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. And then of course they mistake her for a secretary at the beginning. Traditional. Yep. Yeah. Obviously misogynistic men who don't understand the value of a woman, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. So that was maybe some of the early like ham-fistedness that maybe Pete, you were talking about earlier, the stuff that's kind of like bothersome when you start watching it. But I think it kind of evens out and gets a little better. I mean, there's a few digs at the governor, like they take his Airstream and they eat the fucking steaks and you know, they're like, and I love, you know, Red's like approach to it. He's like, well, the governor's not here. You know, what's he going to do?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's more of Eastwood's conservatarianism coming out. Yeah. I mean, he puts a lot of that into his movies. If you watch the movies that he makes, there's a lot of that in him. Even in Gran Torino.
Yeah, he's got a lot of slow builds and a lot of patience in his shots. And I've seen a couple of like documentaries on his directing style. And he's just like, all right, just start shooting. He just like lets it happen. It's kind of amazing in a way that it still gets done. But it definitely has like a slower pace to it. Now, speaking of slower pace, this was a period of time when he was making this where he only wanted to direct because he had just done Unforgiven, starred and directed in. He was doing the Oscar push for that. And I think In the Line of Fire was also a pretty big movie right around this time when A Perfect World came up. And so he was only planning on directing this. And Kevin Costner actually suggested to him, like, hey, I've read through this whole thing, and I think this movie doesn't work unless you are Garnett, or you are Red Garnett. I mean, and Eastwood agreed to it because he doesn't have a whole lot of screen time in it.
Yeah. From what I understand, there is more than one movie that he's directed and, you know, basically ran the show on that he wasn't going to appear in. And he just decided at the last minute. I mean, Gran Torino is one of those movies. It wasn't written for him. And they just decided, well, he's going to be the best fit for it and everything. And then there was one recently where he played like a drug mule or something like that. And that was another one where he wasn't going to play the lead in it. And you know, so I think that happens to him a lot. It's just like, all right, I'm going to be the director. Yeah, but everybody wants to see you act too. You know?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. We did the mule a little while ago. A little while. I mean, who knows? I've lost all concept of time since the scamdemic here, but we did that with Rocky Fehrenberg, and that was a really good episode for a pretty slow movie.
Yeah, that movie's got some issues, but I still love Clint Eastwood. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah, and I want to do some of his older stuff, definitely. And he's got some, you know, conservatarian, libertarian kind of leanings. Some of his quotes are like, hey, I believe in gun control as long as I'm the one controlling the gun. And I would definitely agree with that.
I always wondered about that quote.
Yeah?
Yeah. It always seemed to me, I don't know, I think that quote could be taken that if there is a gun present, I want to be in control of it. No one else. I don't want anyone else in control of it.
Oh, yeah, I guess you could read it that way. I think of it more in the along the lines of, I have a gun and you can have a gun and we don't necessarily need to know that, but we're going to respect each other because that's possible.
I hope so. I hope I got it wrong. Everything to me is negative. I'm looking for the negative in everything. So.
Yeah, I mean, he also did do that weird chair speech about Obama, I think, in 2012.
He's odd. Yeah, he's odd.
Yeah. And I just chalked it up to him being like super old at the time, and now he's even older. He seems old in this, and he was 93. And it's kind of weird because I think of this movie as more of a late 90s or early 2000s, because that's when it came on my radar. I'd heard that this is a really good Kevin Costner movie, like in maybe the year 2000 or something like that. And I was like, oh, it must
be. That's so rare, right?
Yeah.
Look at Robert. I'm just watching Robert's reaction.
Yeah. You know, he's been in a lot of good stuff, but you know, he's hit or miss.
Yeah.
Yeah. Apparently Yellowstone's really good though. My wife and I, we tried watching it and we got maybe 10 minutes into it and we just couldn't do it. It was on Hulu. And Hulu has a bunch of ads in it because we're paying the, you know, the low $2 or $3 a month plan that was on the Black Friday deal. But the other thing about Hulu, which is just driving me crazy, is they do all this woke advertising. Like, oh, God. they have a whole commercial about the Black Lives Matter thing. And it's Hulu. I mean, it's them promoting themselves saying, keep on fighting.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, well, okay, so.
Corporate
the mostly peaceful fighting, or yeah. Are you being more literal here?
Yeah, it's a corporate revolution. I mean, the corporations always lead the revolutions, right?
It seems to be that way. I know Dave's been talking about that. You know, with the 99% scaring the bejesus out of the corporate institutions, and so then they figured, all right, well, let's get these guys fighting each other. The divide and conquer strategy.
Makes sense.
And it seems to have worked wonders.
Yeah, it does. It makes a lot of sense for sure. I don't know if it's 100% accurate, but it makes a lot of sense.
If I were pulling strings, I'd be doing the same shit. So,
yeah, divide and conquer.
Anything to distract away from yourself. I mean, if the government's been doing it for so long, you tell me corporations aren't going to pick up on it, and you know, the press. I mean, come on, the press is the best at it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Pete, I listened to a recent episode of yours with Buck Johnson of the Counterflow podcast, and I love that guy. His show used to be Death to Tyrants, and I know that he gave a speech at Mises event recently, and I think you were there. Did you also give a speech there?
No, it was part of a panel. It was he, Tho Bishop, and Jonathan Newman, and they were just doing a panel. And they each had a very small little window to talk for themselves, and then they answered questions.
And okay.
So, yeah.
All right. That's cool. That's cool. And one of the things that was pointed out in your interview, which I thought maybe tied to this movie just on the name alone, is the quote, "Perfect is the enemy of the good." And this was the argument for the Hoppian style of what must be done on the local level, trying to get into the political arena to sort of dismantle it, because it's what we have available to us. And I'll, of course, link to that episode on this show notes page here. But I wondered if you could speak to that just for a moment and your perspective on it.
On dismantling at the local level?
Well, and perfect being the enemy of the good, where the argument is that when, you know, the quote unquote anarchists like Robert and I, we'd be like, oh, we don't vote, we don't believe in it. It's against the NAP. It's against our philosophy. Whereas maybe there's a bit of a nuance, because there's not a whole lot of avenues necessarily available to remaining entirely principled. Sometimes you have to be a bit pragmatic.
Well, I mean, even if you want to run away from the government, ask Randy Weaver how that worked out. You know, he ran to Northern Idaho, a half hour away from the Canadian border, and they came and found him. I just don't see the idea that we're going to, I mean, I'm almost seeing the non-aggression principle as like a suicide pact, like suicide right now, because it's like, it's like Saul Alinsky said, one of his rules for radicals was hold your enemy to their principles. Mm-hmm. So they, you know, whenever a libertarians are always point out that, hey, you know, they're the most consistent people out there. Well, I mean, the people running the world aren't consistent. They don't care. So if they don't care and they run everything, and they'll kill you and lock you in your house and want to force needles into your arm and force you to carry something in order to, you know, travel, maybe even drive your car over state lines at some point. And what are you going to do? And it seems like it's pretty friggin' usually you have to do something. And I think at the local level, there's a chance for real kind of decentralization and real, you know, you just basically, you know, I wrote an article detailing exactly how I would do it if I had a chance, the perfect way, what I think is the perfect way. Now, it'll never go perfect, but I mean, it'd be as close as possible. But yeah,
what do you
I just don't see? I don't see. I mean, what good is the non-aggression principle? I mean, if your neighbor was stealing from you, you would make some attempt to stop it. Well, the government steals from us every week. No one's making any attempt to stop it. So when, not to Fed post, but when did the bullets start flying? And when does that happen? Or do you just sit there and take it? Or do you try and do something, anything, other than say, I'm the most consistent anarchist I know?
Yeah, they are kind of holding us to our principle, because they are the ones doing the stealing. And yet if anyone sticks their head out, they're going to get that head chopped off. Whereas we're also like, they're way outnumbered. There's that Larkin Rose video, The Tiny Dot. And like, if enough people chose to do the same thing at the same time, of course, that's very difficult to do due to the decentralized nature of individuals. But that seems to be the only thing that would really be effective, whereas little pockets are easy to stamp out, which is kind of the challenge we're sort of facing, being held to our principles as we are.
Yeah. So, I mean, all I can hope for is, it seems like in the last 4 years, 5 years with Trump, then through this election, which really wasn't an election, and into January 6th, where people are calling it an insurrection, where in a country of 500,000 guns, not one shows up to the insurrection. I hope that some people are starting to see how illegitimate this whole thing is, especially when they build a fence around where the lawmakers are. I mean, that should tell anybody. If we saw that in another country, we'd believe that government was probably illegitimate. So
yeah,
I think there's some hope to be held out there, but still got to do something. I mean, just sitting on your hands and hoping that just because you have a consistent ideology that, you know, somehow that's going to be in some magical way. I just don't see it. I don't see how that's going to help at all.
All right. I'm sure there are plenty principled people who were thrown into gas chambers back in World War II.
Sure. Yeah. I've said this over and over again. You'd be the most principled person in the boxcar. And libertarians, if the boxcar is owned by Walmart, libertarians will probably be like, oh, this is cool. I'm going to leave them a good Yelp review. Because it's a private company, bro. I mean,
that's right.
I mean, they're using private companies to do all this stuff now, too, which is just, you know, you want to talk about another spit in the face of libertarianism.
Well, it's another way of giving it the intellectual cover, as in the progressive era, which I think was it Jonathan Newman who edited and compiled Rothbard's
Patrick Newman.
Sorry.
There's two Newmans at Mises, and it's confusing sometimes.
All right. Well, I'm hearkening back to the whole concept of, you know, government using the intellectuals to get cover with the masses to get away with what they want. And so now they're sort of reinventing that or going through an evolutionary process, sort of like we don't have Pravda necessarily here, but we have a more advanced system of it.
Robert's like, well, and here's the thing is I would say that probably the most influential people in the culture are the journalists, and they're not, none of them are academics. I mean, I don't care that Rachel Maddow has a, what does she have from
some degree from somewhere?
Yeah. And it's, I mean, these people aren't academics. These aren't the elite of the elite. These are just people
these are mockingbirds.
They're puppets.
Yeah.
The people they're put in position.
Yeah.
Because of
scholar. That's what I was trying to come up with.
Yeah. And I think it was Michael Malice who put this point out there. And he also has like a white pill that he likes to talk about. I'm a little iffy on it, but I'll entertain him. He makes a point. God, what the fuck was the point he made? Now I got the brain fog again. Oh, that the journalistic class, they'll of course say, well, I don't purposely go out of my way to distort the truth or not report things as they are. And his point back to them is, well, you wouldn't be in a position if you did. You know, like you're there because of how you do things. You've been trained in a certain way to do things the way that they want you to do it. And so you may believe that you're doing the right thing and doing the best job you can, but it's not because you're this hard-hitting objective journalist who's looking at all the facts and actually reporting on the truth of what's happening. You're presenting the narrative. You're factual, but not truthful.
And it's rather interesting that like the big communication schools, like Northwestern, things like that, you see a lot of the people who want to become sportscasters come out of there too, and like ESPN, and then how much has been revealed over the last 4 or 5 years that they all learned the same exact thing that the journalists did. They learned wokeism. They learned there are ESPN anchors who are mockingbirds now. It's amazing to watch. It's amazing. I mean, I haven't watched I used to watch ESPN like religiously. I haven't watched it since like 2016. Ever since Trump started, since the whole Trump thing, I haven't watched ESPN because I saw the way it was going. I saw it back then.
Yeah,
and it makes people like Glenn Greenwald stand out all the more when you see somebody who's actually calling this crap out, and it's quite obvious.
Yeah, I couldn't tell you one other journalist that I think is any worth a shit than Greenwald.
Michael Tracy is good. Matt Taibbi is good.
Matt Taibbi, Andy Ngo does some good stuff. Yeah,
Andy Ngo is great because a friggin' 80-year-old lady could be walking down the street and like bump into something and she's Antifa. I think Andy Ngo thinks everyone he meets is Antifa. So
anyway, we're probably getting to the point where we can start to wind this one down. So do either of you guys have any other points or notes you wanted to bring up before we get into summary and review? And I'm not even sure how to score this thing. Maybe it's only a 6-shooter, but we could give it, you know, a number of rounds in the chamber out of 10.
Well, I've got the big sharecropper scene.
Yep.
If we could get into that, that would be good. So they're sleeping in the car and they get surprised by the sharecropper guy. And so he invites them out of kindness. Hey, sleep in the house. Right on. Go ahead. Come on in and we'll even feed you and everything. And then you can, when the sun comes up, you can be on your way. But then, you know, you see him hitting the kid. Hitting his grandson, I believe.
Yeah.
Right.
Grandson. Yep.
Grandson. And Kevin Costner takes exception to that. He's, you know, that triggers him to use a left term. And I'm not exactly sure what's going through his head And I understand he reacts due to his upbringing and his own sense of morality and that kind of thing. But did you guys get the impression that he was trying to teach the man a lesson at gunpoint? That seemed like, tell him you love him. No, really mean it, or else I'm going to shoot you in the face. It struck me as kind of absurd, even though he had good intentions. Does it really teach the guy to behave better? Is the guy never going to hit his kid again? Is he going to be traumatized by that and never, and actually be more of a good, kind hearted person, or at least, you know, reluctant to strike his grandson? Was this an overall net positive, or was it just completely futile and just shows how broken of a character Kevin Costner is?
I think it's the last one. I don't think he had any idea what he was doing at that time. I think he was blacked out, seeing red, and I don't think he knew what he was doing. I don't think he was trying to teach a lesson. I just think it was all he knew to do at the time. And I think that scene more than anything exposed the fact that, he was, even though he was really nice to the kid, he's a damaged human.
Yeah. I tend to think along those lines too.
I think that maybe in the moment he felt like it was more like he thought he was teaching him a lesson, but not effectively. It was more like, this feels good to do this to you because of how you're treating this kid. And I'm probably going to, you know, I don't know exactly what I'm going to do now, but I might kill you. I don't know. So this lesson's sort of moot, you know, but it was just like that rage, you know, that seeing red, that being triggered by seeing that kid being abused by this man, similar to how he had been abused as a child by his father. And so he wasn't really clear on what he was doing. And I think that's sort of conveyed pretty well in the film, like that. I think Costner even says in later on, he's like, I wasn't sure what I was going to do. So you did the right thing by shooting me, Philip. Philip was his name, right? Phil. Call him Buzz.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that was just to like stop him from, you know, to interrupt whatever he was doing, because he was on this path of, you know, potentially killing the whole family. I mean, if he had ended up killing that sharecropper guy, then it would stand to reason he would need to then do even worse.
Yeah, kill the grandma and the grandson, which would have been a bridge too far from the audience perspective. At least from my perspective, I would have completely lost any kind of liking of the character at that point. I'd be like, oh, you just damned yourself, buddy, at that point.
Yeah. And the scene before that, he was dancing with her. I think her name was Dottie, you know, and like showing his, maybe not his humanity, but his ability to put on a human skin or human mask, you know, to like be sort of that kind of like welcoming kind of get into your good graces kind of way, sort of set you up.
Yeah. I mean, if he doesn't see Grandpa hit the kid, of course, you know, they leave and there's no story, right? I mean, they just leave and they're on their way. So I think he is a multifaceted character, which makes him interesting. He learned how to dance when growing up in this whorehouse, but he has issues and they come out, and he is also not one to shy away from using violence to achieve his ends. And that makes for a very dynamic character.
Right. Right. And there's one other question I wanted to ask you, Robert, before we wind down here. And that is Butch's lesson to the kid about borrowing something.
Borrowing ain't stealing. You're just giving it back to him. What was it? If you really need it. No, borrow. Right. No, he said stealing's wrong. But if you really need it, then it's just borrowing or something like that.
Right. Right. Which seems like a pretty strong contrivance.
He absolutely knew 100%. He had no means to ever pay back any of the things. Like he wasn't going to be able to get the car back to the people. He probably thought that the car might get back to the people eventually, but he wouldn't have been the one to do it. Like the cops would pick it up and get it back to him or whatever. It was nice that he kind of had some kind of sense of moral code, but again, do you think that the average American or the average audience member is going to agree with him in that situation?
Probably. I mean, maybe now, yes, but maybe back when it was made, not so much.
Yeah. I tend to think that if you've got a strong moral code, you're going to be like, nope, close, but no cigar. Whereas these days with a lot of the people on the left, they're like, yeah, of course, you really need it.
It's unoccupied.
It. Fine. It's nobody's there right now. I need it more than whoever else is. So it's an unplanned donation in my pocket. Thank you very much.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I wonder how they'll handle the people who now have three or four houses and can't possibly spend 100% of their time there. You know, are those considered abandoned properties now?
Yeah. I don't know if they get special considerations because she's black, Daniel. I don't know.
I was talking about Bernie, but.
Oh.
Actually, both of them. I've been seeing a lot of those, the memes about the, you know, $1 million houses being purchased. And I like to respond with a Bernie gif, sort of as a double, you know, response, because he's got, what, three or four houses?
Not enough, Daniel.
Not enough. Too many damn houses. Anyway, let's do the wind down here. So let's maybe give it out of number of helicopter rides, because there is a helicopter ride in this one.
I like it. Well done, Daniel. You did mention Hoppe here. So yeah, helicopter rides. I like it. All right. So A Perfect World is not a perfect movie, but it is. It's a well done, despite a few cringy elements and despite a few plot contrivances that really felt like they could have been done better. I really didn't like how he obviously reaches into his back waistband to grab a picture for some reason he's handing him at the very end so that he can go to Alaska, even though it was his dream to go to Alaska. It wasn't the kid's dream to go to Alaska. Why are you giving him that postcard? What? And then the whole escaping the neighborhood without a kid. Are you kidding me? Without a hostage? They could have just drove away, because they did just drive away. They didn't make their way past like a police barricade because they had a hostage. They just drove away like you would out of any neighborhood. Maybe if the writer could come up with a few more believable situations for those things, I would have appreciated it more.
All right. Well, can I, I'm going to let you finish.
You retort against my final summary and review?
Well, I just maybe want to give you a slight update to your information there. I'm going to fact check you. I think he was giving Buzz the list of things that he wanted to be able to do.
Oh, right. It was written on the back of that postcard.
Right. So that has a little bit more meaning. So does that change your perception of that?
Okay. Thank you, Facebook fact checker. That was good. Makes me think you wouldn't really qualify to work at Facebook, but okay. The film itself is quite engaging. It's a character study with some interesting characters in it. And that alone is far above and beyond most Hollywood fare. So kudos. I'm going to have to give you a positive review for sure. I'm not exactly sure how many helicopter rides just yet. I think I have a number in my mind, but I wish that the kid actor would have been a little bit of a better actor. They got out of him what they could, I think, but there were definitely some moments where it just felt like a kid acting, trying to act instead of just a kid actually along on this ride. So, you know, you get what you can, but it's always risky working with kids and animals and that kind of thing. Anyway, the acting is stellar. The writing for the most part is pretty good, but the concept is what's really strong in this film. The concept of just having the fatherless kid and the fatherless adult, put them together, smash them together and see what they talk about and see what comes up. You got the morality of the criminal and the naivete of the kid, the sheltered kind of child that wants to do all these things. And now he's got this big chance to go on this grand adventure. And you understand why the kid wants to go along with Kevin Costner, even though he has the option of leaving at any time. If I was that kid, I probably would have jumped in that car too. It sure made sense to me. And I do enjoy it when I understand the motivations and the characters act in believable ways. So for that alone, it's a great film. It's not the greatest film of all time and it's not a perfect film, but it's like 7.5 helicopter rides out of 10. I really thought it was quite engaging, and more just the great depth of character was really enjoyable for me.
All right. Not bad. Not bad. 7.5 helicopter rides from you. I'm going to echo a lot of your similar sentiments here. I think that the acting is really well done. This is one of Kevin Costner's best films. And I also think it's one of Clint Eastwood's best directed jobs. I think that Unforgiven is perhaps his greatest achievement, which came out right around the same time, back before he sort of got a little bit too old. But overall, I think that it has a really strong premise and a pretty decent delivery. And I even like the subtle digs at the governor in this and road building, as he says that this highway that they're driving on was not finished when he was a kid. And here it was 20 years later and it's still not done. So I thought that was pretty funny. So I, too, will give this a pretty strong rating of 8 helicopter rides out of 10. And we'll go over to Pete on that.
I guess we'll average this out because I want to give it 2 scores. One score, technically, there was just so many like typical kind of tropes. Both of them hitting the FBI agent at the end. And it was just, and then she knees him in the nuts. It was just like, come on. That is just so something that you would expect. And I don't know, there were little technical things in the script that just seemed so, common tropes that you see. So from a technical standpoint, I actually give it 6 helicopter rides out of 10. But from a stepping back and looking at it as a piece of art and as a whole and how it made me feel. And that's the most important thing. I don't think it's a very cerebral movie. I don't think that there's no high philosophy in here. It's just one of these movies is meant to make you feel a certain way. And it, from that standpoint, I would say 8 out of 10. And
I'd agree with you. It definitely hits on those emotional notes. I think it's that father and son kind of vibe that gets developed when you know that both of these characters don't have a father. And so they sort of develop that bond. Pretty good. Pretty good. So high scores all around, 4 scores. And several episodes ago, we had you on for JFK. So we'll have show notes, links to that and all your other appearances for Kevin Costner. The only other non-Kevin Costner film that you did with us was Casablanca, of course. And yeah. I think that one got very high marks. I think it got perhaps a perfect score, if I'm remembering.
Yeah, 10 and 2 9.5s or 2 10s and a 9.5, something like that. It was It's pretty nutso.
Pretty high from the judges. I don't know. Maybe they were high. I don't know. But
I probably was.
So this has been a lot of fun, Pete, and I hope you can stick around for just a little bit longer. I know that you are still trying to recover and whatnot, but we will be back next week, Robert, with a more cerebral film, and that is Eyes Wide Shut, Kubrick's last and final film. Has lots of stuff going on in it, and it's going to have our buddy Mike C on to talk about it. So I think that one will be a pretty chock full discussion. It's a pretty long movie and there's a lot going on in it. It's weird. I haven't seen it since the first time when it came out and I was weirded out by it back then. And that was before sort of my conversion into learning about the philosophy that we adopted. So I wonder how much more I will see in it now.
Yeah, I haven't seen it at all, but I have heard tales of it and how accurate it is to real world. I don't know, but that's what I've heard. So we'll see.
Yeah. I think it'll be really interesting. And I know that there was, at least Mike's mentioned this in the past, that there was a cut that Kubrick wanted to make, but he died before it could be completed. And the question is, was that
a murder?
Maybe. So we'll get into that next week, and we will get into some Kathleen Turner Overdrive right after this. Available for our Patreon supporters at lastnightherbs.com/Patreon. People can also check out our guest, Pete Quinones, at Free Man Beyond the Wall. And you do great work over there. You're also at the Libertarian Institute. We did a donation recently to the drive there. We got the latest Scott Horton book. That was as a result of having Keith on, Keith Knight. Keith is great. Right. We love that guy. And we're going to have him on again pretty soon. We were just on with him talking about libertarian movies or movies that had libertarian messages, but maybe weren't aware of them, something along those lines. But that was really good. I'll put that on the show notes page as well.
That's cool.
So thanks again. And we will say goodnight from last night, everyone. We'll see you guys all next week for Eyes Wide Shut. Peace out.
All right, we're going to continue the transmission on the Action Anarchy podcast for just a few more minutes before getting that Kathleen Turner overdrive. But then we do need to let Pete go, as it is getting late for him and he is recovering from illness. But I always like to save a sort of a racier or spicier question for the end here. So Robert and Pete, and I'll go to Robert first. What was your take on the unspoken language of love between Kevin Costner and the waitress at the diner? I thought that that was really well portrayed. I've in my younger days, I've experienced some of those unspoken messagings and that sort of let you know what's on the table, what's on the menu. And I thought that that was well portrayed in this. And I thought that Costner's, you know, Butch's explanation to Buzz was pretty funny as well. Like, do you love her? Well, of course I did. You saw me kiss her butt.
Yeah, that was a cute scene for sure. I thought it was pretty dang accurate. I don't know if I have any issue with it. It was definitely an entertaining scene. I loved the subtext, the things said without them being said. Why would she even start talking about that? That was well done. I don't know how often something like that happens, but there have been times where that is done. And that is something that definitely increases the excitement when, you know, you're not just coming out and saying it. You're just leaving it up to what's not said. I enjoy that a lot.
Right. And there's like an audience unawares because of how you're doing, or you think they're unawares. I mean, I'm sure they're not always.
But like the kid probably didn't quite understand what was happening, but the adults absolutely without fail knew exactly what was happening.
Right. Now, do you think, and we'll go to Pete with this question. Do you think this was here to further humanize the Costner character, or what was the purpose of the scene being in here?
Maybe to remind you that he was in prison. I mean, that's what all I thought when that scene started. I mean, there was great subtext there was, how long has he been in prison? So he really needs to get this done. And that's pretty much where my mind went, was just like, oh yeah. I mean, this is some good acting and everything. And kid, go wait in the car kind of thing. But I was just thinking, I wonder how long he's been in prison, because he really wants this at this point.
Yeah. I was actually surprised that he ended up walking away from her. I would have imagined that he wouldn't have needed much longer to, before they could be on their way. But
yeah, it was a little bit weird when the waitress started asking about his wife. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know, if you're just picking up some random dude driving by on the highway, are you really asking about, is there a woman involved in your life? I mean, it struck me as a little bit weird, but other than that, I like the scene a lot.
Well, maybe that's related to what we were talking about before, where there's sort of that air of respectability, you know, that Baby It's Cold Outside song that, of course, is played every Christmas season, and people get all up in arms about it these days and calling it offensive. Meanwhile, they're listening to WAP, thinking that that's like the greatest song ever. But the whole concept of that song is that there's certain airs that need to be displayed to be respectable. And so there's subtext about what's really going on here. So, I really must go, wink, wink. But, you know, right. I don't want to.
I really do care about whether there's a woman in your life, right? I do. I'm not just going to bang you right now in about 12 seconds. Yeah,
right.
Yeah, so, you're putting on airs. It makes sense.
Right. And when we were talking about it earlier, it's sort of like when people sort of have a... We were talking about the message that Costner, the lesson that he was teaching Buzz, where it's okay to take something if you really need it. And it's sort of, maybe people have this moral code that they'll contrive themselves, contort themselves into, well, this still fits into my moral code somehow.
And right. So as long as I check this box, then it's okay. As long as I ask about, there's a woman in your life, and he makes up some lie about there not being one, then as long as that's fine. I can sleep at night knowing that I've at least pretended to care.
Right. And maybe it's a mechanism to try to get around the cognitive dissonance that might have occurred, you know, where you're doing something incongruent with your stated beliefs. So maybe a coping mechanism.
So I think there is a fair amount of like psychological stuff going on in this movie on display. So what other, you know, lessons can we learn from this other than that Vienna sausage is gross, by the way?
What?
He talked about Vienna sausages. He asked them to check their supplies. And he said they had like a candy bar and like a couple of other things. He's like,
tater tots. He likes tater tots.
Yeah, Clint Eastwood likes tater tots, as do I. I think they're great. But Kevin Costner talked about, is there a canned meat in there, like Vienna sausages? I mean, I made the mistake of thinking that Vienna sausages were like little smokies just in a can. And so I bought some. They're not that. They're not that.
I see what you're saying.
Yeah. Okay. They are. Do you know what they are? Vienna sausages?
I mean, I've seen them, but I don't know if I've had them in a long last time, so I couldn't tell you.
All right. Well, apparently when they process meat, and this is like made during World War II or whatever to like.
Is this the pink slime?
It is the pink slime. Well, it's not the pink slime you're thinking of that's made with the chicken nuggets. This is different pink slime. This is they've deboned the cut of meat, gotten all the good meat off of it to make sausages and hamburgers and steaks and whatnot. And this is all the bits that are left, and they press it through like these filtered screens, and whatever sludge oozes out and they scrape off, that's not like going to break your teeth, is what they press into these little sausages. And they are Vienna sausages.
Sounds delicious.
Yeah. It's gross. So anyway, that's the high note I'm going to leave everyone on this episode of the Actual Anarchy Podcast.
We end in class. It's good.
We end in very high classy. That should be a really, you know, high-end restaurant menu item, is the Vienna sausage, as it is on our show here.
Can I offer you the Vienna sausage?
It sounds like it would be good, right? Mm. But no. No, it's not. So anyway, this has been a lot of fun. Pete, thank you so much for joining us. People can find you at Free Man Beyond the Wall and the libertarianinstitute.org, among other places, as well as previous episodes with us, all related to Kevin Costner films other than Casablanca. We've done Dances with Wolves, JFK, Waterworld, The Postman, and now A Perfect World.
God, it maybe, is five.
Yeah.
That's wild. And six total, yeah.
Maybe we can do another one. I know Tin Cup's pretty good, and For the Love of the Game. Bull Durham.
I like For the Love of the Game, but Bull Tin Cup might be better because it's got humor. It's entertaining. It's pretty entertaining.
Yeah, yeah. So we'll do another one at some point in the future. Be a lot of fun to have you back, and we will be back next week with Mike C for the Kubrick's final film, Eyes Wide Shut. And with that, we'll get into some Kathleen Turner Overdrive. So thank you guys very much, and we'll see you guys all next week. Peace out. Maximum freedom.
The Chipmunks. Chipmunk. We're the Chipmunks. Guaranteed to brighten your day. Do, 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 do.